A bell rang out in Nagasaki at the exact moment when the city was bombed 75 years ago, 3 days after a similar attack on Hiroshima. Within a week, the Imperial Government of Japan had surrendered.
World News from the BBC. Sri Lanka's former leader, Mahinda Rajapaksa, has been sworn in as Prime Minister by his brother, the current President, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, following his party's landslide victory in this week's parliamentary elections. The oath of office was administered in the historic Buddhist temple of Rajamaha Viharaya. International leaders will hold talks later today aimed at raising aid for Lebanon following the devastating explosion in Beirut on Tuesday. The disaster is thought to have killed more than 150 people and caused up to $15 billion worth of damage. On Saturday, there were furious anti-government protests in Lebanon when street battles broke out between police and demonstrators. From Beirut, here's our Middle East correspondent, Tom Bateman.
The sense of fury is everywhere in a country that was already deeply mired in crisis well before Tuesday's blast, as the recovery efforts continue and the number of dead continues to rise. Today's international online conference, hosted by the French President Emmanuel Macron, aims to raise billions of pounds in aid. But amid the deep distrust towards the country's government, he has said it must be channeled directly to charities and to the people.
At least 30 people in South Korea have been killed and thousands of others have been forced to flee their homes after weeks of torrential rain. In the southwestern regions, major rivers have burst their banks, flooding homes and farmlands. Flights from Gwangju International Airport have been cancelled and bullet train services are suspended in several provinces. A Spanish Roman Catholic bishop known for his tireless work with indigenous communities in the Brazilian Amazon region has died at the age of 92. Pedro Casaldáliga arrived in Brazil on a mission in 1968, in one of the darkest periods of the military dictatorship in the country. He soon became an outspoken voice in defence of the rights of indigenous people and landless farmers. BBC News.
Welcome to the second part of our BBC World Service series, The Senses, exploring what glitches in our sensory system tell us about how we perceive the world around us. My name's Guy Leschtener. I'm a neurologist working in the NHS in London. Today, we focus on vision.
I was working and I had the children and then I was getting headaches and I wore glasses anyway, so I presumed I needed a new prescription.
It's 2008. Dawn, one of my patients, is 29, married to Martin, and with two young children. She's struggling to read.
I was working as a teaching assistant, and I remember one day the class teacher actually asked me to read a letter out to the class. And I actually gave the letter to another member of staff that was in the room and pretended that I needed to go off and do something.
Right. And that's because you couldn't make the words out on the page, is that right?
Yeah.
What about driving? Did you have any issues with driving in that time? Martin is miming at me from the background.
it actually got to the stage where my driving was becoming quite bad. I did actually have an accident. I was coming round a sweeping corner and the sun shone through the trees and I actually hit the back of a double-decker bus.
So you didn't see the bus?
No.
Okay.
And then got to the stage where Martin actually said to me, if you don't go and get your eyes tested, I will divorce you.
When we see, we imagine our eyes like cameras, taking a constant snapshot of the world around us. But the process of vision is so much more than our eyeballs. The first step is the passage of light through our cornea, the transparent window at the front of the eye. It's then focused by our lens onto the retina, where the light-sensing receptors convert light into electrical impulses. But turning these electrical impulses into meaning, recognizing colour, shape, what an object is, where it is, how fast it's moving, is performed in our nervous systems, our brains. Arguably, we see with our brains, not just our eyes. But disruption of any part of this highly complex system, from the first point of entry of light to the areas of the brain responsible for complex processing, will result in problem seeing. Dawn's problem is not due to needing new glasses. She's diagnosed with several benign tumours, one of which is pressing on the optic nerves, the crucial link conveying signals from the eyes to the brain. Dawn has an operation to remove the tumour threatening her vision, but it may be too late. The pressure on the optic nerve's been going on for a while now.
I'm Sui Wong. I am a neurologist and also a neuro-ophthalmologist. It's a specialty that combines both vision and the brain. If you think about it, like if you're pressing on your body, say on the skin, if you press it for long enough, the blood flow to the area of the skin will be affected. And of course, and then we remove it so that blood flow will be restored. But let's say if there was a situation where there was a crush on the area and the pressure is not relieved, and then the tissue would die off because of blood flow being affected to the area.
And that's what happened to the optic nerve, is it?
Yeah, because of the damage to the visual pathway, the information is not getting through to the brain.
Even now, it's like looking through a very, very thick fog. I can't make out faces, have no sight at all in my right eye. Mm-hmm. Peripheral vision's gone. Majority of the colours I can't make out. I can go into a shop with Charlotte and show her a jumper that I think is very nice, that is cream, and it turns out to be a luminous pink. Yeah, so I do struggle with things like that.
In the left eye, is there any patch at all where you can see clearly?
There was, if I tilted my head a great deal and actually had my chin on my chest. Mm. I had a very, very small area in which I could make slightly more out, I suppose, than through my normal vision if I was looking forward. Mm-hmm. But then over the last year, 2 years, I've now developed a black spot in my central vision in the left eye, which then causes more of a problem.
Dawn has lost almost all her vision, even though her eyes are working normally. Her loss of sight is caused by pressure from one tumour squashing the cabling and damaging the nerve fibres that pass messages from the eye to the different areas of the visual brain. Another of her tumours is affecting a different sense, as you can hear in our episode on touch. Before her diagnosis, Dawn's deteriorating eyesight had been hard to ignore, but sometimes we may not even be aware of the absence of vision.
My name's Ollie, I'm 25, and I'm a filmmaker. I live in London. Me and my friend, we're filming and directing like music videos at the moment to try and work our way up.
About a year ago, a silly game with a friend leads Ollie to discover something extraordinary and alarming about his vision.
Basically, we were working one day, and he was quite bored because he gets distracted very easily. He started poking me in the face and I couldn't see it. And he was like, why can't you see this? Like, he was just like shocked that I couldn't see anything. And I was like, I don't know, like, I didn't think anything of it, and it sort of left my mind.
But it pops back into his mind a few weeks later when he's at the doctor's with recurrent headaches.
She just very casually did a field of vision test with her hands.
This is to check how much Ollie can see on either side when he's looking straight ahead, his peripheral vision.
And I couldn't see her left hand when she was doing it, and she was very shocked at this, which is never a good sign when your doctor's shocked and confused.
What worries the doctor is that Ollie is missing half his vision. On the right-hand side, he can see nothing.
So she sent me off to an emergency optometrist, mm-hmm. who was also... did another field of vision test and was also very shocked. Said I had the vision of someone who'd had a stroke.
Confirmed by more tests and an MRI. Pretty devastating news, you'd think, to be told, age 25, that you've had a stroke, causing damage to an area of the brain called the primary visual cortex, where awareness of vision first starts. But the curious thing is, Ollie's not aware of having had a stroke, or even that half his vision is missing. And the reason is, Because?
They said the most probable cause was a stroke, maybe when I was being developed in the womb or just straight after birth, which would have given me this sight of a stroke victim.
A classic case of not missing what you never had.
It didn't seem to affect anything. I just, didn't notice. Even now, I don't even realise that I have a chunk missing. In my day-to-day life, I just forget about it.
With hindsight, there are clues. In a previous job as a runner in the TV industry.
I'm quite clumsy, and I thought I was getting good at, like, walking around people quite quickly. But people always used to walking to me from the right-hand side.
Right.
Something I've noticed a lot more since discovering why I'm a bit clumsier. And it, when thinking back to all the stuff I've broke and smashed in my house, it has always been on the right-hand side.
Has it?
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And what's even more curious, even though Ollie can't see stationary objects in his right visual field, if they're moving, he's aware of them. It's a very rare phenomenon called Riddick syndrome. It basically involves a shortcut, so visual information can still get through to the areas of the brain that detect motion, even though some pathways to the main processing area for visual awareness are damaged by the stroke in Ollie's case. Dominic Fitch is a reader in visual psychiatry at King's College London's Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience.
Evolutionary, it's thought that this is something to do with the need to detect moving stimuli, perhaps prey or danger signals, particularly in the corner of your eye, very quickly so you can respond to it without having to go through the full machinery of normal vision. Because the short circuit to the brain has allowed information to get into the motion processing area, gives you the conscious experience of motion, but you haven't got any information going into colour, form, all the other bits, etc. So you have this pure conscious experience of movement.
Ollie, does it make you think a little bit about what the reality of the visual world around you actually is?
Yeah, definitely, because it brings to the fore, like, how each person's perception of the world is definitely different. Because in filmmaking as well, there's different aspect ratios. So whilst now I feel like other people are looking at it in widescreen, I'll be in like a 4:3, so a bit more of a traditional 1940s film ratio, which is different rather than inferior, I'd say.
Normal vision is a series of steps. It only starts in the eye before information then passes to the brain through the optic nerves. It is here, in the visual areas of the brain, that we truly experience the world that we see. Colours, shapes, movement, location, and so on. For some people like Ollie, vision can be impaired by damage or underactivity in the visual cortex. But for others, the problem can be overactivity in these regions of the brain.
You guys really are into your music, aren't you? Everywhere I see, there's some sort of musical reference.
Yeah, we're big Glastonbury fans, right, as well.
We're in Manchester, in northwest England, at home with Nina. She's 37 and a big fan of the music of 1990s Manchester. On almost every wall, memorabilia celebrating the Stone Roses, the Happy Mondays, and other bands of that era.
When I was 2 years old, I caught the flu virus, and then that attacked my eyes. The virus burnt itself out and left my eyes with lots of different problems. Yeah.
So, as a kid, what was the best your vision was?
Very foggy. It was like looking through a steamed mirror, in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to use magnification or large print.
Nina has several eye operations over the years, including corneal grafts. Each surgery initially makes her vision clearer, but then it fogs up again as her eyes reject the grafts. Then, in 2008, a breakthrough. A pioneering surgeon operates again, this time treating her with drugs to suppress her immune system.
It went really well. The graft was successful. And straight after the graft, I was always wary that, oh, it's just going to fail like it has done every other time. So for a year, I had amazing vision. I could read a newspaper for the first time in my life without having to use a magnifier.
Wow.
So it didn't only clear the vision. So, yeah, I was over the moon.
That joy doesn't last long.
So a year to the week, pretty much, from me having that surgery, I had an accident at work where I lost the eye. Something fell on me and the corner of it basically caught my eyeball and burst it.
Oh, my gosh.
And they couldn't save it at all. It was definitely a life-changing moment.
And yeah. So they couldn't save the eye?
No, it was completely gone. So they had to remove it and then replaced it with the artificial eye.
Nina must now rely only on a poorly functioning left eye, but her surgeon wants to wait for things to settle down before trying any further surgery. It's a long wait, 8 years. Her surgeon recommends a partial corneal graft.
Of all the surgeries I've ever had in my life, I've always been put under general anaesthetic, so put to sleep. And for this one, he was like, oh no, we don't need to do that. And I was like, really? But it was amazing. When I'd come round from that, again, my vision was clear and I could see well again.
It gives her the confidence and the passion to start her own business, an arts and crafts creative cafe, which takes off.
Yeah, I was really busy. And looking after my son, yeah.
That's full on.
Yeah, and I think because I was so determined to do it and to make it work, I kind of neglected myself. And then I think that's where it all started to unravel.
So what do you mean by unravel?
I think I just took too much on. And then one morning, it was a Wednesday morning, 29th of August, I was getting my son ready for school. Still does this to me now, sorry.
Do you want to take a pause?
Okay. Yeah, I was getting my son ready for school and we were having a bit of a clear out in the house. So we had bin bags everywhere. I was trying to do the payroll for the staff. So instead of moving the bags out of the way, like a normal person would do, I was rushing. I climbed over, leant down to get something out of the briefcase and basically headbutted the corner of the TV. And it kind of done the same thing as the right eye.
So you had a massive retinal detachment, did you?
So I'd lost, they couldn't save the retina. So now I only get a little bit of light perception. And straight as soon as I'd done it, within that millisecond, I knew what I'd done.
So that was the point at which you basically lost all your vision, is that right?
Yeah.
Nina's remaining eye, without a functioning retina, is now blind. Surgeons try desperately to salvage her retina, but 95% of it is lost. As she comes round in the hospital ward, Nina has something important to tell her mum and husband, who are by her bedside.
I could see, like, colours, and it was like waves of, like, red and blue, very, very muted, not bright at all. And I said to them, I said, I can see something. And then obviously I could sense them two twitching, and, oh, my God, what she said, she could see something. Oh, she might be OK.
The doctor who comes to review her tells her it's just her imagination.
The doctors were very blunt about everything, you know. You have lost your sight, you'll never be able to see again.
But over time, Nina's visual experiences progress.
They started turning from waves into shapes, into patterns, into different colours. It kind of went from that blue, reddy brown, then yellows, greens, oranges, purples, all kinds of different colours started coming through. At points it could look like a kaleidoscope. It just started developing and getting more intricate, more colours. over time. And at first, I didn't really want to tell anybody, because obviously the first time I told someone, I was just shot down. Eventually, the shapes started turning into faces.
What kind of faces?
So everything that I see, it's kind of cartoony, so animated, but then the faces started appearing and they were like zombie faces. Even though they were animated and I knew that they weren't real, they were still scary because they had like blood dripping from the eyes and like gnarly teeth. By that point, I got quite scared. So yeah, we went back to the hospital, you know, demanding answers from the doctors. I spoke to my consultant. She was like, yeah, it is Charles Bonnet syndrome.
Charles Bonnet syndrome describes visual hallucinations caused by loss of vision from eye disease. The brain, starved of information from the eyes, generates its own images to fill the gap. Dominic Fitch again.
It's anything that reduces visual input from the eye to the brain.
What sort of level of visual loss is required?
So the charts that you have in your optometrist or high street eye checkup, halfway down the chart puts you at risk of Charles Bonnet syndrome. But if you have worse vision than that, your chances of having these visual hallucinations goes up.
What do people actually experience?
Well, there's a whole range of experiences. Squiggly lines, simple shapes, rainbows, that sort of thing. And then about 80% of people see a very consistent, regular, geometrical pattern. Lots of people get a disembodied face. It's an unfamiliar face and it's often described as distorted, and so it's got an overall grotesque appearance. And then we have the famous figures. They tend to be in some kind of elaborate costume. Knights in shining armour or Napoleonic uniforms, that sort of thing.
These hallucinations are caused by spontaneous firing of cells in parts of the brain responsible for vision. But their nature depends on the particular visual area of the brain which is overactive.
If it's spontaneous activity in the area of your brain that's normally involved in processing colour, you will see a colour blob in the world in front of you. And if it's in the part of the brain specialised for seeing faces, you'll see a face in front of you and so forth. And it's the machinery that we're using on a day-to-day basis to see the world around us. And when there's a glitch in it, we see the person, the figure, the pattern when it isn't actually there.
Nina has these hallucinations constantly.
At the moment, as I'm talking to you now, there's kind of like a blue sausage river. And then to the bottom, it's like a patchwork kind of face. And it's greens, blues, pinks, but they're all very muted colours. And again, it just changes. It's like, as I've spoke now, it's changed again.
But when the colours and the images become too intense,
I find it really hard just to function because that's just there in my way.
Is it distracting you?
Yeah. I find myself walking into walls a lot more, walking into door frames a lot more, tripping more.
So if you were to completely get rid of these hallucinations, mm-hmm. that would be a good thing, would it?
Well, I don't know. I ask myself that question every day, especially on the bad days, because I just want it gone.
Yeah.
But then I think, well, when they go, then what am I left with? Just darkness. At least now, I still have something to kind of see.
So strong is our brain's desire to see that it generates its own visions if left to its own devices, which in Nina's case can be both comforting and distressing. These individuals and their experiences show what happens in us all as we survey our world through our eyes. That vision is not like a video camera, a straightforward process of turning light into a picture. That we see with our brains and nervous systems, not just our eyes. And that process we all perform of creating sense of the world is almost unbelievably complex and vulnerable.
Since all this has happened, I honestly truly believe that this is where I'm meant to be. Here, doing this, sharing it with the world, creating awareness. This is why I'm going through this journey, so that other people can hear it and learn from it and hopefully help other people go through the same thing.
I'm Guy Leshtzimmer. This programme was produced for the BBC World Service by Sally Abrahams. Next in the series, we'll be looking at hearing, how the ear and the brain work together to fill our lives with sound.